Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is author and literary journalist Carmela Chiraru. Chiraru is a graduate of Columbia University's Journalism School. She is a member of the National Book Critics Circle and Pan American Center. She has written for The New York Times, The Boston Globe, The Huffington Post, and O, the Oprah magazine. Her anthologies include First Loves, Poets Introduce the Essential Poems That Captivated and Inspired Them, and Solitude Poems. Her most recent book is a fascinating look at authors who take pen names. It's called Nom de Plume, A Secret History of Pseudonyms, and it was published in June by Harper. I'm speaking to Carmela Chiraru by phone from her home in Brooklyn, New York. Carmela Chiraru, thank you so much for joining us. Now, I want to talk to you about Nom de Plume, obviously. We live in such a celebrity-infested culture, it's hard to believe that people once hid behind secret names. So what was it that got you interested in this book?
Well, I've always been interested in issues of identity, and I think that, you know, it is hard to believe that there was once a craving for privacy and secrecy as opposed to fame, and I'm really interested in that. When I sort of got into the subject, I didn't quite know what I was taking on, and it proved to be an overwhelming amount of research, but it was also a lot of fun, as you can imagine.
Oh, the book itself is fun, too. It's fun to read about all these people. Now, you picked an approximate 100-year period, the mid-19th century to the mid-20th. Well, why that period?
Well, I kind of thought that was a good stretch to tell these stories. I first had to figure out where to start. And although there are pseudonymous authors that predate the Bronte sisters, to me, I think that's the first kind of epic and amazing and fascinating story to tell. So once I figured that out, I knew I would start there.
Mm-hmm.
And then figuring out where to end, I only wanted to cover authors who were not living. And I don't know, it just sort of worked out that Pauline Rayage seemed like a good end point. So it's kind of funny that I start with Victorian England and I end with an S&M novel in France. But there you go.
You do cover some interesting ground. Well, let's begin with Anne and Emily and Charlotte Bronte. To tell us a little bit about them. They used men's names in order to get published. Was this because of the times?
And it wasn't. I mean, I think one of the happy discoveries of writing this book was that many of my assumptions proved incorrect or at least flawed. And that was obviously the first place that I started from is, oh, okay, so the Bronte sisters and George Eliot, you know, they were women, they couldn't write as women, so they wrote as men. And that is true, and it certainly was indicative of the era. But what I found out was that there were women writing, not many, but literary fiction at the time, like Elizabeth Gaskell. And so it's really sort of a matter of degrees. I mean, the kinds of books that the Bronte sisters wanted to write were very transgressive for the time, more so than other kind of just literary fiction. And they certainly deplored what we would today call chick lit. You know, they didn't like these kind of superficial, frilly books written by women. They couldn't stand that. And in the end, I think they just wanted to write books that would be taken on their own terms. So even if they had published this themselves and won praise, they worried that the praise would be sort of like, oh, you know, good book, you know, not bad for a woman, kind of in this condescending way. And whereas if they wrote as men, they said, well, the books will be taken strictly on their own terms and judged by nothing else, and they were right about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's a fascinating story. That the three sisters took on the name Bell, Acton, Currier, and Ellis Bell. So they chose to pretend like they were brothers, which
and they took the first initial. Acton was Anne, Kerr was Charlotte, and Ellis was Emily. And Charlotte posed as their agent. She would write letters on behalf of these brothers, signing off as C. Bronte. And the truth is that Emily was not really interested in publication so much. It was really Charlotte who was the driving force. She was incredibly ambitious and, to me, incredibly brave and admirable for what she was taking on.
Because
you know, they were these three frumpy women in the middle of nowhere, and they were about to make their mark in this huge way, thanks to Charlotte. I mean, she was absolutely relentless in pursuing it.
And we certainly have evidence of their brilliance, too, that continues through the centuries. It's amazing. Now, you also cover Lewis Carroll, and I find his story really fascinating. Talk to us about him.
Yeah, well, he was someone who certainly could have published under his own name, which was Charles Dodgson. But he, in his case, he really wanted a very clear divide between his private life, which was, being a mathematician at Oxford and being a religious man. And he didn't want Lewis Carroll to have anything to do with his day life. And he deplored fame, I think probably more than any other author in my book.
Mm-hmm.
He bragged to a friend in a letter a few years before he died. He said, "For 30 years, I've managed to keep these two personalities distinct and to avoid all communication with the world about my books." And he really had. I mean, he absolutely refused to address the world as Lewis Carroll. He wrote the books, and then he was sort of done with it. And, you know, Queen Victoria was a big fan of Lewis Carroll's, and they wrote a letter to Dodgson asking for, more of his work. And because she wrote to him, he sent her mathematical texts that he had written. He wouldn't send her anything by Lewis Carroll. So he was just very mortified by publicity, and he refused to sign autographs and just incredibly private. Something that I found really interesting was apparently in the first edition of this massive reference book, which is a dictionary of anonymous publications and pseudonymous publications, he actually begged the editor to be left out of it so that his name wouldn't be cited as a reference, and it was. So here you have, one of the most famous pseudonyms in history and one of the best-selling books of all time, and he's not in that edition of the book.
God, that's amazing. And you know what? I didn't know he was a mathematician. I had to read your book to find that out. And it makes sense to me, because Alice in Wonderland seems almost like mathematics to me. You know, the rabbit hole and all the intricate visionary, imagination in the book. It's amazing.
It really is. I mean, there's a precision to it that, makes sense in the context of his mathematical background. And he also, as I mentioned in the book, he invented a number of things. I mean, he was really this polymath. And, he created sketches for like a three-wheeled bicycle, and he invented this kind of new postal money order and double-sided adhesive strips. And, I mean, like everything you could imagine. It was kind of amazing, all the different things that he invented, aside from just being this amazing writer.
Did you ever think during your research that some of these people really could not have created, like Alice in Wonderland, if they hadn't been able to use pen names?
Yeah, I think for sure Charles Dodgson is someone who had a kind of crippling shyness and was half deaf and had a stammer. And, he was a very awkward person socially, at least with adults. He certainly would never, ever have published his literature under his own name.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously for some of the women, I just think that some of them would have written because they needed to write no matter what. And they wrote, hugely in their personal lives, like George Sand before she died. She was writing since childhood her entire life, and she left behind like more than 100,000 letters at her death. I mean, it's hard for us to imagine that number, staggering number, but she's always writing. But I think having the pseudonym allowed her to write publicly,
mm-hmm.
in a way that she wouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some cases are more extreme than others, and some you could argue would have published anyway eventually. Certainly in the case of Sylvia Plath, I don't think she would have published The Bell Jar ever unless she had found a pseudonym because of her relationship with her mother. Probably the most extreme case in the book and the most tragic is Alice Sheldon, who was a debutante from Chicago. And I think that's just the most dramatic case of someone who really, really needed a pseudonym to write and who was ultimately destroyed by it.
Mm-hmm. To tell us a little bit more about her, to tell people what the name of her book is.
She published several books, but they're basically out of print. You can find her work in libraries. At the time, which is the late 1960s, she was a hugely popular science fiction writer known as James Tiptree Jr. And it's one of my favorite stories in the book, even though it's the saddest, and it was very difficult for me to write. the story of how she found her pen name I really love. She was at the supermarket with her husband one day, and she knew that she wanted to write science fiction, but she was too shy to write under her own name. And so she knew she would need to write under a man's name because it was, you know, male domain. And so they saw a jar of the Wilkin and Sons marmalade, you know, I'm sure you've seen it,
mm-hmm.
and the Tiptree jam. And so she said, oh, James Tiptree. And she just came out with it, and her husband said Junior. And they just both started laughing, and then that's how the pseudonym was born.
Wow.
So it's a really funny story, you know, finding it at the supermarket on a jar of marmalade. But anyway, I mean, she was, you know, as I said, very successful, and no one talked to Tiptree on the phone, of course, and no one met him, none of his editors, none of his fans, no one did. But he had this huge correspondence, and in his letters, he was very flirtatious with women and very confident and, you know, very unlike Alice Sheldon, who was really reclusive and withdrawn and kind of a depressive person. Tiptree was a completely different personality. And when that pen name started to unravel for her, she found that she was unable to write. And you know, he really left her unable to function as a creative person anymore. I won't give away the whole story, but it ends quite tragically, and she commits suicide, and it's just kind of a long road leading up to that sad ending.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite an astonishing story, but I think that Tiptree gave her some of the happiest and most fulfilling years of her life, and so it's hard to kind of, you know, untangle how much of it is really sad and how much of it maybe kept her alive longer than she might have lived.
Yeah, yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Carmela Chararu. She has written a book called Nom de Plume, A Secret History of Pseudonyms. Now, I was thinking that the running theme through Nom de Plume is that authors using pen names, it gives them this freedom to write as someone else. Don't
yes.
you think that's really an incredible mystery? That I don't understand how that works. Talk to us more about that.
You know, I've actually talked to a number of contemporary authors who have used pen names, and they've all described it the same way, that they feel kind of this giddiness and a kind of exhilaration and this illicit thrill. It's like having this private secret space in which to work. It's like if I said to you, well, here's this room and you can lock it and no one will ever know you're there and you can create anything you want. I mean, there's something really amazing and beautiful about that. And that's what a pen name provides. It's just something completely private and for yourself. And when we're freed from the baggage of our past and our shames and our humiliations and our anger and everything that's attached to who we are in our childhood, you know, just to lose all of that and reinvent yourself is incredible. It's an incredible feeling, at least at first. I mean, as I tell in some of the stories in this book, the pen name too can become a hindrance, and certainly in the case of James Tiptree, as she eventually committed suicide. But for a while, it's this amazing feeling. You're tricking the critics, and you're, you know, you're protecting yourself against fans who might expect a certain kind of book from you than you're going to deliver. And you can do anything you want, and there's no consequence, and there's no responsibility. We see some of that today. People use pen names to write on message boards, you know, write about politics or whatever. But to me, anyway, I see that as more of a kind of cowardice, because they're sort of just spouting these angry opinions, or they're trashing people, and they're using a fake name. And I just think that's really different than the stories that are in this book, where authors were using deception to create, you know, really great works of literature in most cases.
Yeah, I understand what you mean, because a lot of people do use fake names and start trashing people on blogs and stuff. It's entirely
yeah.
different. Yeah, I understand what you mean.
Or, you know, they say really offensive things or ignorant things, and like a pseudonymous author, they don't have to take any responsibility for it. But then again, they're not creating something that is, you know, a work of art in some respect. But yeah, I mean, you know, some of the authors in the book I quote talk about that feeling of excitement of getting to start all over again. And in the case of Isaac Dinesen, who was Karen Blixen, she said that she used a pseudonym because she didn't want to answer questions that all authors have to answer, which is, you know, oh, did that really happen to you? And did you really mean it when you said this? You know, authors who write fiction are constantly having to say, no, it didn't happen to me. I actually create, you know, I invented it from my imagination. And she just didn't want to deal with any of those questions. And so that's why she used this protective cover.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk about Mark Twain, too, because you talk about how humorists in the 1800s often used pen names. Well, what was the reason for that, do you think?
Well, yeah, it was kind of a tradition at the time, and it wasn't something to be taken seriously. And so a lot of them dabbled in pen names to sort of have fun with humor writing. You know, it wasn't something that was terribly well respected. And I think that goes to why we know Mark Twain today, and we don't know so many of those humorists who were very popular in his era. And that's because he went on to do more than newspaper writing and humorous writing. He created Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer and these enduring works. And he, even at the time, was very aware of the ephemeral nature of fame and popularity. And he said, no, I want to, you know, be one for the ages. And so he very much set out to accomplish that. He was kind of the first rock star in American literature, really.
Now, as compared to the 18th and 19th century, it seems like authors often use pen names to separate serious work from, you know, work that might be considered lighter. I'm thinking of people like Ruth Rendell using Barbara Vine and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true now more so than it was back then? It seems like more serious writers were writing serious work under pen names.
Yeah, I mean, I know, I can think of, there's another author I actually did a radio show with who talked about wanting to separate genres, and it was partly psychological, like for the author's sake, to be able to, okay, now I'm going to write this way, and, you know, having a little bit of a buffer. But it is also for the fans, so that they kind of know, oh, they're getting this kind of book from J.D. Robb, and they're getting this kind of book by Nora Roberts. And even though obviously they're aware that it's the same person, I think it's sort of branding, and it's a little bit of a distinction there.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk also about George Orwell. He's made such a huge mark on our culture. You know, we call things Orwellian.
Yeah.
His real name was Eric Blair.
Yeah, Eric Blair, yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about him.
Well, something funny that I've learned, I've been on this book tour for a while, and I've been surprised at the number of people who actually didn't know that George Orwell was a pseudonym.
Mm.
So that was kind of interesting to learn. A lot of people said, oh, I had no idea that his real name was Eric Blair. But, yeah, there's a couple of things here, and that's one thing that I found in writing this book, is that there's never really one straightforward fixed reason why people use a pen name. The motive seems to shift over time, and there's sort of a couple of things going on at once. Orwell came from a well-to-do family, and he wanted to write about, you know, the working poor, and he didn't want to cause any embarrassment for his family, and he also knew that they would consider it inappropriate, which they did. And so there was that motive. But also, he'd had some trouble getting his first book published, and so he said to his agent, look, if there's any chance you do get this manuscript accepted, will you please see that it is published pseudonymously, because I'm not proud of it. You know, he felt ashamed that he had had trouble even getting it published. So he considered different pen names, and someone said, why don't you just sign the book with the letter X? And there was a little bit of vanity involved, because he said, well, wait a minute, what if I actually do well?
Oh.
You know, I want to have a name that I can use, and you can't be X, you know. So he played around with, I think it was like H. Lewis Always and P.S. Burton, and then George Orwell, which was his favorite. And so it's kind of funny that, as you said, we've ended up with this word Orwellian in our lexicon. It could have been Burtonian or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he went with Orwell, and there's some different reasons that people have speculated about the origins of the name. One was that the first name, George, came from this 19th century writer, George Gissing, who was influential, and that Orwell came from the River Orwell in England. But in any case, you know, he proceeded with it in all of his works, and even after people knew that George Orwell was Eric Blair, he still wanted to maintain that separation. Some people say, well, why don't you just legally change your name to George Orwell? And he said, no, I want to be Eric Blair in my private life, and George Orwell is the author.
Yeah. I want to continue talking about Orwell, though, because you talk about how Orwell was traumatized by prep school and by a lot of his early experiences. Do you think taking on pen names sort of gives people courage in some ways to get over who they really are?
Yeah, I do. I mean, he was very introverted, and, you know, he basically hated school. He went to these very elite boys' schools, and he just was absolutely miserable. And so, yeah, as someone who was not handsome, was not particularly wealthy, was not athletic, you know, unpopular. Yeah, I mean, George Orwell gave him a kind of courage that he didn't have otherwise. It was, you know, one thing that I always come back to is superheroes. You know, you think of Clark Kent or Bruce Wayne, you know, these ordinary people in their daily lives getting dressed up in this costume and having these superpowers, you know, and that's kind of what a pseudonym does. And certainly in the case of Orwell.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't stand the snobbery at, you know, the boys at his school, and so he was really reacting very bitterly against all of the privilege in his background and by inhabiting this other identity.
Mm-hmm. I was just interested in the fact that his most famous books, Animal Farm in 1984, were published toward the end of his career, so didn't people know his real name by then?
Yeah, they did. They did. I mean, at that point, he really, I think you could say, was more of a brand, and he wanted to keep up Orwell, even though people who he'd gone to Eton with wrote to him and said, look, you know, I know that you're George Orwell. I mean, he just sort of left it intact. And that's true of some of the other authors in the book, like George Eliot became a best-selling author, but she'd never reverted back to Marianne Evans, and Charlotte Bronte, too. She became a hugely best-selling author, and even after her identity was exposed, she kept up Currer Bell to publish by.
Mm-hmm.
So it just becomes something for the author as some kind of separation, like I'm not that author, I'm myself in my private life, and then this other name is my working life, and it's just a little bit of a divider.
I want to go back to Isaac Dinesen, too, because her real name was Karen Blixen. She was Danish, but I found from your book, and I have read her, I've read Out of Africa and Gothic Tales and a lot of her books, I didn't realize that she wrote in English, even though she was Danish.
Yes, I know. I was really interested in that, too. And she translated her own books, and she sometimes rewrote parts to kind of fit the audience she was writing for.
That really fascinated me that she wrote originally in English. Let's go back to Patricia Highsmith, though, because I think a lot of people would be interested to know that, you know, not only did she write those famous Ripley books, which have become part of our culture, too, she wrote one of the first lesbian novels with a happy ending, under the pen name Claire Morgan. Talk to us about that. The Price of Salt, it was called.
Yes, that was the original title. Yeah, and that's another thing I've found at many of my events. People had no idea that she'd ever done this. It's still a somewhat obscure work. It's certainly in print. I think W.W. Norton just reissued it not long ago. You know, at the time, which was 1952, it would have been unheard of to publish such a book, one that wasn't pulp fiction or, you know, something like that. I mean, she wrote really this literary, beautiful, positive story of a relationship between two women. And as I talk about extensively in my chapter, she was really, really quite a nasty woman in her private life. I mean, there's no disputing that, and I wasn't spinning anything. I mean, I was kind of doing the opposite in my research. I was looking for people to say nice things about her. And I mean, it's almost comical how horrible she was. She was absolutely nasty to everyone around her. She was just, I mean, it was truly shocking how cruel she was. And, you know, after a primary relationship, maybe the longest lasting she had, ended with the writer Mary Jane Meeker, she then wrote a book in which a character based on Meeker was viciously stabbed to death for several pages at the end.
That was amazing.
It is amazing. I mean, you know, but I sort of became fond of her because she was so crazy in her awfulness. And yet she wrote this book that people wrote to her and said, thank you, you saved my life, or thank you for representing me in a positive way. And she did something good in her work that in her personal life she was incapable of doing. empathy, kindness, love, support, any of those things. It was kind of absent from her life. And I think she was someone who, you know, she fulfilled her own wishes through the price of salt. You know, she never had a happy long-term companionship in her own life, and so that was kind of a perfect story to write. And there are other writers in my book who struggle with issues of sexual identity. You know, they're confused about their sexuality or whatever, and she wasn't, but she was very, very private about her sexuality, and she didn't want her pen name exposed until it was just a couple of years before her death and she admitted she'd written the novel.
Mm-hmm. During the course of your research on this book, did you come upon any surprises and anything that really shocked you?
I think that the elaborateness of some of these, I guess to be reductive, call them hoaxes, some of these authorial hoaxes, I had no idea that they were so extensive and that some of these writers went to such great lengths to protect their secrecy, their privacy. That was kind of amazing to me, what some of these writers did. You know, the story of Romain Gary, I think, was one of the most surprising as well. And he was the best-selling French author of the 20th century. He's not well-known here at all, and his books are hard to find. I love his work. But he was someone who inhabited a pseudonym to escape fame and then became just as famous under his pseudonym. So he was trapped by fame not once but twice. You know, it's an amazing story of what he went through and his adventures. He was a war hero and, you know, married this famous Hollywood actress. I mean, he had this incredible life. And so I was surprised by the layer upon layer of deception in that story. It was like it got weirder and weirder. And I just couldn't believe that as I was researching it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carmela, we are almost out of time. Can you tell us if you're working on anything new? And can you talk to us a little bit about it?
Well, I try not to talk about new things while they're still new because they're very delicate, I guess you could say. But I have a couple of ideas that I'm working through right now. And to be honest, I'm still very consumed by Nom de Plume. I'm still doing events and I'm going to the Miami Book Fair next month, and it's still taking up a lot of my time, which I'm very happy about because I loved working on the book, and I think it's going to be hard for me to let go of it and move on to the next thing, but I'm slowly making my way toward something else.
Okay. Well, can you give some contact information so people can get in touch with you?
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to give my email out. It's CIURARU@gmail.com. And my book, Nom de Plume, has a page on Facebook. And I have a website, which is CarmelaCiuraru.com. It's CarmelaCiuraru.com. And the book is pretty widely available, and it's on Amazon and so forth.
Great. Well, Carmela Ciuraru, thank you so much for joining us again. The book is called Nom de Plume, A Secret History of Pseudonyms. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tish. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.